Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're embarking on a truly fascinating journey, one that takes us right to the foundations of Western civilization and faith. We're going to explore Jesus, but maybe in a way you haven't focused on before, specifically as the Son of Israel.
That's right.
Our guide for this is, it's an incredible set of sources, a multi-volume Jewish commentary on the Gospels. This isn't light reading. It's a really rigorous exploration, and it illuminates Jesus's life, his teachings, his whole context through an authentically Jewish lens.
And our mission today really is to cut through some common assumptions, maybe uncover some surprising facts and profound insights.
Mm-hmm.
We want to reveal the historical Jesus within his own vibrant culture,
mm-hmm.
give you a shortcut perhaps to clarity and a fresh perspective, a well-informed one.
Okay, so let's dive right in. Where do we start his public ministry?
Yeah, the sources suggest he was immersed, baptized probably somewhere between mid-September and the end of September.
Okay.
And then he started choosing his first disciples a bit later, maybe around December or January. Could have been after the Feast of Succot at the temple, possibly.
Right. And he centers his ministry in Capernaum. What's significant about that place?
Well, Capernaum, Kfar Nachum, it means village of comfort. But it was much more than that. It was a key border town, had a Roman garrison, lots of travelers passing through.
Paying taxes.
Exactly. Roman road and customs taxes. It's actually where Matthew, the tax collector,
right.
worked.
Ah.
And the move there, perhaps it was due to that lack of respect Jesus apparently faced in his hometown, Nazareth. You know the saying, a prophet has no honor.
In his own town.
Right. Right.
Makes sense. And the disciples he chose there, any sort of surprising details about them?
Oh, definitely. Look at Andrew, one of the first. Traditionally, he's the patron saint of Russia, Greece, and Scotland. Quite a reach.
Wow, okay.
And the tradition says he was crucified on an X-shaped cross. Then there's Simon, who becomes Peter. The sources mention he was married and, importantly, possessed the gift of prophecy.
Gift of prophecy, interesting.
And his mother-in-law, seemingly wealthy, had this large house in Capernaum, conveniently right across from the synagogue.
So a perfect meeting place.
Potentially, yeah. A natural hub for the early followers.
But Galilee itself didn't have a bit of a reputation. I remember Nathaniel's comment.
You do. Yes. Nathaniel, a Galilean himself, asks pretty sarcastically, can any good thing come out of here?
Yeah.
It reflects Galilee's bad name, mm-hmm. especially among Romans. It was known for producing rebels, often seen as harboring, unwanted elements. Yet that's exactly where Jesus chose to base himself. Not Jerusalem, not somewhere more prestigious. It says something, doesn't it?
It really does. And staying with Jesus's connections, his family, this part in the sources really caught my eye.
Mm-hmm.
They state pretty plainly he had brothers, which, challenges certain traditional Christian interpretations about Mary.
Yes, the perpetual virginity concept.
Yep.
The sources are quite direct on him having siblings.
And even more telling is why they came to see him. The sources say it wasn't really to hear him teach.
No, it was apparently for some sort of business.
Right. And that encounter prompted Jesus to give this profound teaching about who his true family is.
Exactly. Defining a brother or family member as someone who obeys and does the Torah really reframes those relationships in spiritual terms.
Okay, let's broaden the lens now. Moving from his personal circle to the wider Jewish life he lived in, the wedding in Cana seems like a great starting point.
It really is. It opens a window into ancient Jewish marriage customs. We see things like erusin, the formal betrothal.
An engagement period.
Sort of, but more binding. And then kiddushin, the actual sacred bond of marriage, emphasizing its holiness.
And the detail about it being on a Wednesday.
Ah, yes. That's significant. According to Mishneh customs, a Wednesday wedding indicated the bride was a virgin.
Why Wednesday specifically?
Well, it was linked to market days and the availability of witnesses. Wednesdays ensured more people would be around for the necessary testimony. It's quite practical, actually.
Fascinating. And other customs. Rings. Circling.
Right. The idea of kinyan, acquiring something of value, eventually evolved into giving rings, symbolizing endless love.
Hmm.
And the bride circling the groom seven times, that symbolizes a sevenfold bond. Echoing the 7 days of creation, like sealing the new household.
Mm-hmm.
Very symbolic.
Okay, and here's a surprising factoid from the sources.
The breaking of the glass.
Exactly. It didn't happen at Cana.
Correct. Because the temple in Jerusalem was still standing. That custom came later as a way to remember the temple's destruction, even during moments of joy.
Wow. Okay. So beyond weddings, what about daily religious life? Prayer.
Central, of course. Jews observe three distinct communal prayers daily. Shacharit in the early morning at dawn.
Okay.
Mincha in the afternoon, which originally connected to the temple sacrifices.
Right.
And Moriv, the evening prayer. Jesus, like any observant Jew of his time, would have followed this rhythm.
And the mikveh, ritual immersion. What's the key takeaway there?
The key is understanding its purpose. It was never just about getting physically clean. In fact, you had to be scrupulously clean before immersing.
So its purpose was purely spiritual.
Precisely. Spiritual cleansing. It was essential for Gentiles converting to Judaism, and the whole nation of Israel practiced it on Yom Kippur as an act of repentance. And the sources are very clear. Christendom got the idea and concept of baptism from this Jewish custom. The roots are deep.
Which leads us to another institution, the synagogue.
Right, developed during the Second Temple period, really stemming from the Babylonian captivity.
So it wasn't always there.
No, it evolved from occasional meetings to daily gatherings. Eventually, it took over many functions of the temple, especially after its destruction. Prayers became considered a substitute for sacrifices.
But the home was still primary.
Absolutely. The sources emphasize that while the synagogue was vital, the home remained the real sanctuary for the Jew. Daily life, daily prayers happened there.
Okay, this is crucial. What about the Torah itself? Jesus' relationship to it?
This is a point the sources stress heavily. Jesus was loyal to the Torah. He did not introduce a new law.
But what about terms like abolish and fulfill? They often sound like he was changing things.
That's a common misunderstanding. Those words, abolish and fulfill, were actually known rabbinic technical terms.
Technical terms, meaning?
They're related to interpreting the Bible, how you understood and applied the law. Abolish meant to misinterpret it lightly. Fulfill meant to interpret it correctly and weightily. It wasn't about discarding the law at all.
So it was about correct interpretation, not replacement.
Exactly. A foundational rabbinic belief was, not a letter shall be abolished from the Torah forever. Its relevance was considered eternal. Understanding this really re-centers Jesus within his Jewish context.
Okay, let's use that context to unpack some specific teachings.
Yeah.
The Beatitudes from the Sermon on the Mount. Poor in spirit, for example.
Mm-hmm. The sources connect this directly to the Hebrew words ani, poor, and anav, humble. It wasn't just about material poverty, but referred to those who were, you know, humble before God and remained loyal to the Torah, especially during difficult times, the pious.
So a kind of spiritual resilience rooted in Torah observance. What about the next one? Blessed are those who mourn. Is there a deeper layer there too?
Yes, very much so. The commentary suggests this isn't just everyday sadness. It's a profound pain and suffering that springs from deep in the heart. A soul yearning, almost screaming in silence, for the physical presence of God in a broken world.
Wow.
That kind of deep existential mourning is what leads to true comfort, the comfort of God's presence eventually.
Mm.
It's far more intense than just feeling sad.
Okay, now for one that really challenges common assumptions, an eye for an eye.
Huh.
What do the sources say about how Exodus 21.23 was actually understood in Judaism?
Right, this is a big one. The sources are absolutely clear. Judaism never interpreted that verse literally. As in physical retaliation, never.
Never. So what did it mean?
From very early on, he was consistently understood as demanding financial compensation for injuries. Justice, yes, but achieved through monetary payment for the damage caused.
So restitution, not retribution.
Precisely. It's about making the injured party whole financially, not inflicting an identical physical injury. This shifts the perception of Jewish law entirely, from harshness to a system focused on restitution and repair. Paying with money versus paying with your body or life.
That's a fundamental shift in understanding. So applying that kind of nuanced contextual reading, what about Jesus' teachings on divorce and oath? Was he contradicting the Torah there?
Not according to these sources.
Yeah.
His views on divorce, for instance, align quite closely with one major school of thought at the time, the school of Shammai.
Shammai.
Yes, they were stricter, permitting divorce primarily for unchastity, unlike the more lenient school of Hillel. Jesus seems to be siding with the Shammai interpretation here.
Okay, so aligning with an existing interpretation and oaths.
Similar situation.
Yeah.
His instruction to make no oath at all, just let your yes be yes and no be no, wasn't totally out of the blue. This emphasis on absolute truthfulness, avoiding oaths which could be misused, was also reflected in other Jewish writings of the period.
So again, not necessarily introducing something brand new, but emphasizing a particular strand within Jewish thought.
Exactly. He's engaging with the ongoing legal and ethical discussions of his time.
What about love your neighbor? That sounds universal, doesn't it?
Well, the sources suggest we need to look at the original Hebrew terms. Neighbor, which is ria or chever, typically referred to a friend, or more specifically, a natural member of the nation of Israel, a fellow covenant member.
Okay, so not everyone.
The term stranger or foreigner, ger, was distinct, and there were separate, very important commandments about how to treat the ger justly and kindly. So the original command, love your neighbor, seems to have had a primary focus within the covenant community. This doesn't negate kindness to outsiders. Other commandments covered that, but it specifies the initial scope of that particular command.
That clarifies the original context significantly. Shifting slightly, how did Jesus approach healing and casting out demons, according to these sources?
It's interesting. He apparently performed healings without invoking God's name or using magical rituals, which set him apart.
But his disciples used his name.
Yes, they were empowered to heal and cast out demons using his name. Now, belief in demons was widespread in the first century.
Mm-hmm.
But the sources point out that the Tanakh, the Old Testament, actually says absolutely nothing about it until relatively late, around the second century BCE.
Really? That late?
Yes. And crucially, the commentary asserts there's no biblical evidence that a genuine follower of God can be under full control of a demonic spirit. The idea being the Holy Spirit and an unclean spirit couldn't permanently co-dwell.
Okay, that's a specific theological boundary they draw. Let's move towards the identity and mission aspects. Israel as salt of the earth and light to the nations, metaphors or more?
Much more than just metaphors, according to the commentary. They're seen as a positive description of Israel's God-given role. Israel is God's chosen tool to enlighten the nations. Salt preserves and adds flavor. Light dispels darkness. It's an active, ongoing mission, a divine purpose.
A purpose. And this connects to Jesus' core message about obedience, doesn't it? When he talks about doing the will of his Father.
Absolutely. Yeah. The sources are very direct here. Doing the will of his Father was definitely a reference to keeping the Torah.
Keeping the law.
Yes. Jesus himself is quoted as saying, it's more important to keep the Torah than to perform miracles or to prophesy or to cast out demons. That really underscores his priorities. Obedience to God's commands, the Torah, was paramount, even over displays of spiritual power.
Wow. Putting Torah observance above miracles, that's powerful. And this commitment, this path, leads to that analogy of the narrow and difficult way compared to catching a flea.
Or pishpesh in the Aramaic Hebrew. Yes, it's a very down-to-earth image.
Like trying to thread a tiny needle or catch something elusive.
Exactly. Think about catching a flea. It requires focus, diligence, constant attention. The sources suggest this metaphor wasn't primarily about a path to eternal salvation as much as it was about the demanding daily practice of living according to Halacha.
Halakha, the Jewish code of law.
Right. It's about righteous living here and now, the meticulous moment-by-moment effort required. Jesus was consistently upholding the teachings of Judaism, encouraging adherence to God's Torah, showing that how we live reflects who we truly follow. That makes the narrow path much more about ongoing practice than a one-time decision. And this brings us to the Nazarenes. Who were they?
These were early Jewish followers of Jesus. And what's fascinating is the historical evidence cited in the sources shows they continue to exist as distinct communities well into the 4th and even 5th centuries CE.
That late. What characterized them?
They maintained strong Jewish identity and practice. They observed the Sabbath and kept the biblical holidays. They used both Old and New Testaments, but notably with the exception of Pauline writings.
No, Paul. Interesting.
Yes. And their core beliefs were in one God, his child Jesus, using that term, and the resurrection. It reveals a stream of early Jewish Christianity that remained deeply rooted in Jewish tradition, quite distinct from the direction Gentile Christianity took later. So wrapping this all up, what's the big takeaway for our listeners from this deep dive?
I think seeing Jesus firmly as the Son of Israel within his authentic Jewish context is key.
It shows his life and teachings weren't about starting something completely separate, were they?
Not at all. It was about fulfilling, interpreting, and deepening the existing covenant and traditions. His message was grounded in the Judaism of his day.
Understanding that framework helps us see the consistency in his upholding of the Torah and how his ideas often resonated with or participated in ongoing rabbinic discussions.
Exactly. And it reminds us, as the sources imply, that knowledge is most valuable when understood and applied. Context is everything.
So the question we'd leave you with is this. How does seeing Jesus as a Torah observant Jew, living fully within that vibrant first century Jewish world, maybe reshape your understanding? Does it make you want to revisit certain texts, certain ideas you thought you knew? What new, perhaps surprising, aha moments might emerge from seeing him through this ancient yet fresh lens? Something to think about.